you haven't been listening. Some Maxine wrote, with all due respect to our remarkable 90-year-old church leader, we find his words unfathomable in the face of reality. Many Mormon women have expressed profound dissatisfaction for generations, privately and publicly, loudly and clearly, in print and in person, alone and in numbers. Thus, we write to correct a misconception repeatedly set forth by LDS church leaders in the media. Mormon women are not content. We do have complaints. In fact, so many women have expressed dissatisfaction that numerous feminist efforts have come and gone, and women have been disciplined by the church. Some cases so publicized that every LDS leader is probably aware of these difficulties. For example, in 1988, hundreds of women contacted LDS church headquarters asking if they could participate in the priesthood blessing of their own babies. During the following years, women who tested this or other political issues were censured or disciplined. Between 1993 and 1996, some of these women were excommunicated. Mormon women are in a bind. If we disagree, we reap trouble. If we relent, we lose our voice. When our leaders say they hear no complaint, it is because they have intimidated women into silence and compliance. Few women will risk excommunication. Yet, if we say nothing, we support the false impression that we're content. Our choice is to conform, to risk church discipline, or leave. This leaves only one recourse, to raise our voice in public if we wish to be heard. Leaving is not a solution. Mormonism is more than a religion, it's our cultural heritage. To leave Mormonism is to leave our culture, our ethnicity, our society, our life, our family, our inheritance. We and our grandmothers have built this church, creating the community, bearing children, cooking, cleaning, caring for everyone, doing the daily labor necessary to make Mormonism work. We carry the Mormon vision while denied the right to conceive it. We bear great responsibility for the success of our community without power to define our responsibility or ensure its success. This is disheartening at best, exhausting at worst. Meanwhile, President Hinckley speaks of 100 Mormon temples looking heavenward. Mormons have been building temples for more than 160 years. Like the legendary fine china crushed into the stucco of the first Mormon temple, making it sparkle, women have poured their lives and hearts into the church for seven generations. For 100 years, our grandmothers exercised their religious voice and authority, giving blessings, creating policy, leading women's programs, and publishing women's views. Yet in our church today, women's programs, leaders, and texts, even the leading women's speeches, are designed or governed by men. All church doctrine, theology, and policy are created by men. While women may be included in discussion about issues and policy, the decisions are still made by men. It's a circular problem because decision-making is tied to priesthood. Thus, if women disagree with male leaders, we are often ignored or dismissed, marginalized or ostracized, until our religion feels less like home and more like another brick-and-mortar building. This puts women in a position of having to choose between our conscience and our church, between our fulfillment and our heritage. We live in contradiction and dissonance, our hearts breaking. Yet, in the New Testament, we find the premise upon which the Mormon Church was founded. James 1:5 promises that God will give wisdom liberally to all. This scripture clearly tells us that women may receive God's wisdom as well as do men. Personal spirituality is the core of Mormonism. Yet men often tread upon our religious freedom, intrude on our voices, and inhibit our relationship with God. Only we ourselves can determine if God is working through us. Men may deny the existence of female theology, but it remains for women to decide and define. We're not content to be denied our voice, nor our decision-making role in Mormonism. our intent is simple, to speak for ourselves and have our rightful place in church governance. Meanwhile, church leaders continue insisting that women are happy in their place. When President Hinckley repeated this misconception again in the Boston Globe, it struck a nerve. Boston conjures images of female suffrage and the American struggle for independence. If there's a way to discard false claims about women into Boston Harbor, we would do it. Instead, we unitedly attest that men do not speak for Mormon women. We speak for ourselves, unwilling to remain silent nor to leave. We sign our names, knowing that every woman on our list will be questioned by her church leaders, warning her to retreat. For this reason, a number of women who wanted to sign were afraid to add their names to this letter. And for every name on our list, we suspect hundreds more feel the same. And there you have the list. And the 27 new names added since this editorial was repeated in the Salt Lake Tribune. Now, if any of you here have whose names are not on this list and would like to add them to it, I'm going to pass this around. If you'll put your name on it and the city and state where you live, and then hand it to Sonia at the end of the program, Maxine will be glad to add it to the list on the because this is posted on a website. Thank you.
In October 2000, Mormon feminists made history by publishing a group statement in the Boston Globe. Why was this historic? There have been few declarations created and signed by a group of Mormon women and published for the secular public, perhaps no more than half a dozen. And of those, only a couple have been feminist statements contradicting the church or its leaders. What began as a private feminist email discussion in September 2000 quickly caught fire. Within 2 weeks became an editorial with 56 signatures submitted to the Boston Globe. What prompted this sudden surge of feminist activism? What was its purpose? What strategies were employed? What did it accomplish? And what does it indicate about the status of Mormon feminism? I'll attempt to begin to answer these questions. First, I'll give some historic perspective on Mormon women's public declarations. Second, I'll comment on the editorial's impact and implications, what it indicates about Mormon feminism. Third, I'll discuss the responses and results to the Globe editorial. Without a doubt.
Why the Boston Globe? Do you have anything to do with women in Boston
No. What happened was that the remarks that President Hinckley made that prompted the editorial were in reference to the opening of a temple in that area. And so it had local implications. And then Maxine approached the editor there, asked if they would be interested in the editorial, and they said yes. They didn't publish the signatures. And then with that success, Maxine approached the Tribune, and the Tribune was willing to publish the signatures. So that's
so
what happened.
The area is because it's on the Internet, it's all over.
Yes, all over. All over. Thank you. Trying to find my place again. Okay. Without a doubt, the Globe editorial is a rare historic text, a kind of Mormon feminist declaration of independence. It was a bold affirmation of women's right to their own autonomous voice. Signed by 50-plus Mormon women, it refuted the views of LDS Church President Gordon B. Hinckley in a major public newspaper. This was a brave act. Mormon women rarely feel entitled to make authoritative statements about the church, its leaders, or even their own views. And Mormon women have had limited options for expressing or publishing their own views. It's also rare for Mormon women to critique the church and its leaders publicly. I wanted to get a sense of how many feminist statements are similar to ours. Of course, there's a long tradition of feminist discourse in Mormon women's publications, the Relief Society magazine, the Young Women's Journal, the Women's Exponent, and the Nauvoo Relief Society Minutes. One of the earliest feminist statements was Emma Smith's denunciation of polygamy in the 1842 Relief Society Minutes, bolstered by her claim that she, quote, had as much authority as anyone, close quote, referring to her husband Joseph Smith and his apostle Brigham Young. Mormon women were boldly feminist and resistive to male controls within the context of their private meetings, private journals, Relief Society forums, and publications. Feminist statements have also flourished in Mormon women's independent publications, such as Exponent 2, Mormon for ERA Newsletter, and the Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly. In public or secular discourse, however, Mormon women have tended to be supportive of the church, despite feelings otherwise. For example, during the 19th century, Mormon women were publicly adamant in their support of polygamy, while privately expressing pain, frustration, and unhappiness with their polygamous lifestyle. The same was true of motherhood and childbearing, as well as burdensome church responsibilities or the demands of establishing the church and homesteading in the Utah desert. Women also struggled with the limitations of narrow gender roles. These dissenting views were aired in women's forums and Mormon women's publications, but rarely in public discourse. Of course, Mormon women have and do make public statements, yet relatively few are collective statements with signatures, and most are in support of church leaders. Precious few feminist statements take issue with the church, especially publicly. After a cursory review, a few texts pop up as examples of Mormon women's declarations in secular public discourse. 1842. In response to the accusations of John C. Bennett against Joseph Smith's practice of polygamy, several Mormon women joined together signing a document that defended Joseph. It asserted that women knew of no other form of marriage than that between one man and one wife. Unfortunately, it was inaccurate. By 1842, several women were already married to Joseph Smith. Ironically, one of the women who signed was Emma Smith. This document attested women's views in support of the prophet. In the late 1870s, a public petition was presented to the U.S. Congress in defense of polygamy, signed by Mormon women. This declaration or petition was accompanied by a rally supporting polygamy and protesting federal control. Once again, this was a public document signed by Mormon women, but in support of the church agenda. Women's suffrage in 1870s and 1920. Historically, Mormon feminism has paralleled secular feminist trends in social movements, both nationally and internationally. Mormon women were passionately engaged in the American women's suffrage movement, joining forces with non-Mormon feminists across the U.S. Mormon women wrote, supported, and signed secular documents supporting women's suffrage and appeared in published photographs with secular feminist leaders. These secular feminist statements supported the church position that women should have the vote. World War I. Mormon women embraced a number of causes at the turn of the last century, during the period of the 1890s to the 1930s. One was the U.S. peace movement before and after World War I. A declaration of peace supported by Mormon women was written in connection with the national peace movement. This was both a public and a feminist document, but did not critique the church or its leaders. 1970s. The ERA period produced the strongest examples of Mormon feminist statements challenging LDS church positions. Many appeared in private forums and Mormon publications, rather than in public discourse. Mormon women wrote and signed several statements and letters to the First Presidency. both the Exponent 2 and Mormons for ERA newsletter published and signed articles and signed statements by Mormon women who supported the ERA. One full-page statement issued a direct attack on the LDS Church position and was signed by both men and women. Other feminist statements were issued in public forums. Some of the boldest and most strident statements were not printed, but were physical. Women chained their bodies to the gates of the Bellevue, Washington Temple and gathered for protest at Temple Square in Salt Lake. There was even a flying banner pulled behind an airplane which read, "Mother in Heaven Loves ERA," soaring over Temple Square and downtown Salt Lake. It was definitely a feminist statement intended for the general public, and it made the newspapers. In 1978, Sonia Johnson's passionate pro-ERA speech delivered before the U.S. Senate subcommittee was a feminist text in a distinguished secular forum, contradicting the LDS Church position. Sonia paid the ultimate price for this act, cross-examination by Orrin Hatch. Oh, and there was also the excommunication. In 1978, a feminist pro-ERA brochure entitled Another Mormon View of the ERA was published by the Equal Rights Coalition of Utah. This was a public statement defending the ERA, written and signed by 36 Mormon women and men. Not only did it refute the church position, it was likely a direct response to the church's pamphlet, Mormons for the ERA. I think this is a word, a kind of a joke word, Maxine made up, signatories. It sort of refers to the signatories who are part of a... Signatories? Oh, is that a real word? Okay. Okay. I'll start over. Signatories include Christine Durham, Esther E. Peterson, Frank E. Moss, Rebecca Cornwall, Kathleen Flake, Lucy Beth Rampton, Algie Ballas, Thelma E. White, Sherilyn Cox-Binion, Sharon Lee Swenson, Marilee Latta, Anita Murphy, Nancy F. Cater, Rodello Hunter, and Paul Swenson. This brochure was intended for public distribution, was overtly feminist, and openly countered the church position on the ERA. To my knowledge, none of the signers were disciplined for this statement. In fact, their sense of safety indicates a different climate during the 70s than that of the 90s. Had such a brochure been published two decades later, I suspect the signers would have encountered punitive measures. Which brings me to another type of secular text, a book. One good example of a collective feminist statement published in the secular sphere advocating alternative views is a feminist anthology. Between 1976 and 1996, a half dozen such books, including Mormon Sisters, appeared, including Mormon Sisters, Sisters in Spirit, Women and Authority, and Mormon Mothering. Last, we have the 1999 Relief Society Declaration, a public statement ostensibly representing Mormon women. It was a formal mission statement of the Women's Relief Society issued as a public document, yet it was not created by women, nor did it convey women's views, but was conceived, composed, and designed by the Brethren. Perhaps a pseudo-woman's declaration, it was an apostolic prescription for women, Mormon women, offering a male perspective as a woman's voice. A feminist version of the Relief Society Declaration soon appeared on the Internet, urging women to write their own declarations. This was not a collective woman's statement, yet, like all the pieces I've published in newspapers, it was a feminist statement in secular discourse countering an LDS church position. I don't know how many Mormon feminist statements have appeared in secular discourse. That may be impossible to determine. However, I have two more observations. The first is that Mormon women are more likely to be heard by their brethren when they publish their dissenting views in secular public forums rather than in private or women or church discourse. And one can't help noticing that there is power in a collective feminist statement where many women's voices unite like a mass reflection of God, attesting the reality of female experience and perspective. This section is on the impact and implications of the editorial for Mormon Feminism. Yes?
That paper just said that the proclamation was authored.
Yes, let me read it over.
For you. That means that the deciding of the Board of Presidency didn't first design it?
No.
What she says is that it was conceived, composed, and designed by the brethren. If they do write anything, it has to be approved by the brethren anyway. Right.
So this says it was conceived.
Conceived by the brethren.
First conceived by the Relief Society.
Right.
Leadership, and then presented to the brethren for their.
It appears not. That I'll mention to Maxine that there was a lot of interest in this because it would then become incumbent upon her to provide more information, and she'd be glad to do that. And it's interesting that this is a particularly interesting part of her paper that to which we're all reacting strongly and deserves further study. Yes? Yeah.
So, her question yeah. is that Mr. Crocky told some of us that were meeting at one time that it had absolutely nothing to do with the Reading Society Manual. They had been asked to study it for a 2-year period and present an outline for a manual, and when they were finally called in to do that, the brethren presented them with what they had come up with, that this is what we're going to do. So it was the Reading Society Manual, had absolutely no input.
Right.
So you were present when she said
yes.
it?
I was present also. Yes, I was there when she said it.
They were dumbfounded. Mm-hmm.
Yes. They had worked for 2 years, I believe, to construct some ideas to present to the brethren on that issue.
The women needed and what they
exactly. Reflect their own conversations with Mormon women, and they were very disappointed by it. Both of them promised us. I think Sister Clyde did that to me, and Sister Okazaki made that promise to others. But she promised that after she was released, she would speak publicly in whatever forms she had on the things that she had learned about what Mormon women need, what their needs really were, as opposed to what the brethren said. And I think that she has kept, or both of them have kept their promise. I've seen newspaper reports, and I've also had people tell me of that Sister Okazaki came to my parents' ward and she said things that were kind of upsetting, and some people were really happy about it and some people were very upset, and they would tell me what it was, and what it was that Mormon women needed different messages from the ones that they were getting from the approved sources in the church.
She also said that they could not request any brethren, that they literally never spoke to the brethren unless the brethren called them.
That's true. That's true. And really, what you're underlying is Maxine's point that the only way that Mormon women can get the attention of the brethren is to speak in a secular forum. Right. The Globe editorial merits evaluation due to several unique qualities. Its authorship, its bold position and language, the object of its focus, its audience, its strategy, its life or will of its own, its timing, its indication, its reactions, and its results. Under authorship, the idea emerged in discussions about President Hinckley on a feminist email list. Strategies were discussed by several women and a few men. I drafted an editorial and passed it by the others, including Courtney Black. then revised it with the suggestions and ideas they all offered. I used Courtney's ideas in every paragraph, notions about profound dissatisfaction, women responsible for a Mormon vision they didn't create, pouring themselves into Mormonism like fine china and temple construction, churches becoming just another brick-and-mortar building, living in contradiction with hearts breaking, Mormonism as more than a religion, choosing between our convictions and our heritage. The final version was edited and corrected with input from the others. Then women began signing their names regarding position and language. We purposely chose a centered, strong position speaker from our own authority, neither appealing to male permission nor protesting or reacting to male control. We simply wanted to inform the brethren that they were intruding on our voices and that only women can speak for women. We wanted to strike a balance of self-confidence with respect for others, validating our own views while not invalidating that of others. The signers were diverse women, some active in the church, some inactive, but with one thing in common. All were determined to be self-defining. This was the position we used. Our own sense of self is what defines the dynamic we create with others. We can change any relationship because it's not so much where we are in relation to those in power, but how we behave. We can lack formal position, yet still have great power via what we say, how we speak, how we behave. When we speak with conviction and the power of our own experience, we have authority. Regarding object of focus. The object of our focus was LDS men who presumed to speak for LDS women, specifically LDS church president Gordon B. Hinckley. It's unheard of for feminists to publicly refute the church president, who is revered as a prophet. Yet our editorial was a specific reply to his statements about Mormon women. We publicly refuted his statements, correcting them as erroneous. While our intent was not to embarrass or provoke him, we saw his statements as intrusive, erroneous, and harmful to women, usurping their voices. We felt a responsibility to reclaim our voice. Regarding the audience, we wrote the editorial as a response to an interview published in the Boston Globe intended for a general audience of anyone who might access the Globe. We also planned to publish it in the Salt Lake Tribune. We assumed both a Mormon and non-Mormon audience in Boston and Salt Lake City. Regarding strategies, several conscious strategies were employed in the text of the editorial, which Courtney and I discussed at length. One, speaking from personal authority from our own voice. Two, validating and respecting President Hinckley while also correcting his error regarding us. Three, asserting the validity of women's personal experience in all of its diversity. Four, warning in the text itself about the likely negative church reaction to our statements as a means of warding it off and protecting the signers. Five, maintaining a balance of tone that was strong and confident, but not agitated, emotional, or shrill. Regarding a power and life of its own, the editorial clearly had a life of its own. Even before I had finalized the editorial, women began forwarding it to friends. Comments came back from other women, I didn't even know, saying, "This is great. We've talked about wanting to respond to Hinckley on this for months. I had no idea so many other women felt exactly the same way we did." I didn't circulate the editorial for signatures because I assumed that the Globe wouldn't print very many. Yet women were passing around so fast, I began getting dozens of emails from women asking if they could add their names. The response crescendoed until I was inundated with emails. Within 2 weeks, there were 56 signatures and more coming. I was flabbergasted. I found myself overwhelmed by hundreds of emails, feeling like a midwife trying to facilitate birth on a cosmic scale, barely able to cope. In order to accommodate the list of growing signatures and give them visibility, I created a feminist website where the editorial could be displayed. Meanwhile, the volume of email inquiries and a need for discussion prompted me to create two private email lists for news and dialogue. The Mormon Feminist Network was born. After publication in the Globe, signatures kept coming until 27 more appeared on the website version. Since then, a dozen more women have submitted their names. Regarding timing,
The timing felt right, very much a window of opportunity that carried its own power. President Hinckley had made his statement so many times in the media for several years that it was begging for comment. Three factors converged in late September to give our statement timeliness. Bostonians were protesting the Boston LDS temple about to be dedicated. Hinckley's interview appeared in the Globe. LDS General Conference was coming up in Salt Lake. We wanted to get the editorial into the Globe soon after the Hinckley interview, coinciding with the Boston temple dedication, and before LDS Conference. Our editorial appeared on October 7th, a week after the Boston temple dedication and the week of LDS Conference. The editorial appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune on October 15th, 1 week after LDS Conference. Regarding indications, the number of women who supported or signed the editorial was surprising and indicated that a growing percentage of Mormon women are dissatisfied, either speaking up or dropping out. I began to notice in this shift among Mormon women in 1998-99, a new wave of feminism emerging from the eerie, silent, fearful aftermath of the 1993 purge. Where before Mormon women were afraid to speak up, now it seems that a critical mass is forming of women who are finding their voices and their feet. I've never seen such a widely ranging feminist wave of women so centered and so self-possessed. They have a sense of certainty about their disillusionment with the church and their own personal connections to the divine. It seems to be a zeitgeist, a massing of large numbers, a critical mass. Regarding the role of activism, in Mormon feminist tradition, women have used writing, publishing, and activism to make statements. This editorial combined all three approaches to create the strongest possible feminist statement. The Globe editorial recognized and embraced the equal importance of intellect and action. Regarding multi-general aspect, among the signers, we had five mothers with one, two, or three daughters who also signed. We even had one three-generation family of signers, a grandmother, a mother, and daughter. Coincidentally, the grandmother's name was Marjorie Hinckley Ebert, a cousin of Gordon B. This multi-generational feminism unites family members rather than dividing them, connects generations of Mormon feminists, and demonstrates that feminism is not merely recent or aberrant in Mormonism. Regarding reactions, these were immediate, and I'll discuss them in the next section. Regarding results, three women got a reaction from church leaders after the editorium. Two of those three were Courtney Black and I. What's interesting is that the reactions we got indicated two things. One, the brethren did not take notice of the editorial, did take notice of the editorial and pass copies down the line to others to make further inquiries about our intent. Two, the approach taken to both Courtney and I was positive, conciliatory, reaffirming, not negative, punitive, or threatening at all. This alone represents a shift in attitude from the 1993 or even 1995 attitude when Janice Allred was excommunicated. It seems that the approach of the current administration, that of Gordon B. Hinckley, is not punitive towards feminists, but positive. Two factors may influence this. Hinckley learned from the purge and prefers to diffuse conflict rather than to exacerbate it. The purge, I think, is the 1993 excommunication of what they call the September 6th. As Hinckley himself was the object of our editorial, he was embarrassed, and thus he doesn't want to make the same mistake again. In the past few speeches, President Hinckley seems to be making some concessions to feminist views. However, the main LDS Church reaction or result of our editorial was the standard one most often used by LDS male leaders: silence. Ignoring women's voices is the surest way to minimize them. Regarding responses and results, the Globe editorial appeared on Saturday, October 7th, with only two signatures, that of Courtney Black and myself. The Globe wouldn't print the other names due to op-ed policy, but referred to the 56 women who signed the submission. In order to give the signers visibility and credit, I created a feminist website where the editorial was displayed.
A week later, on Sunday, October 15th, the Salt Lake Tribune printed our editorial with 52 of 58 names we submitted, excluding six pseudonyms. Within a few weeks, 27 new names were added to the website, and a dozen more have submitted since, bringing the total to about 90 names. This is nothing short of astonishing when you consider the potential church reaction to any woman who signs. She is risking church discipline. During the 1993 purge, you would not have found women willing to take such a visible risk. Today, 90 are willing to put their names on the line. The Globe editorial received a variety of responses: a rebuttal editorial, letters to the editor, a news article, email responses, email discussions, forwarding of editorial on the internet, private word of mouth, and private discussions. Maxine lists quite a few reactions and letters here. In the interest of time out, I will read only a part of what she has written. But certainly the Dion editorial is one of the most significant of the responses. The Dion editorial was a formal published rebuttal that appeared in the Salt Lake Tribune 1 week after our editorial on October 22nd. Elizabeth Harmer Dion, an active LDS woman in her mid-20s from Boston, responded to our editorial with the blessing of her local LDS church public affairs specialist. In Latter-day Saints, feminism is much stronger than many want to believe. To acknowledge or believe was the title of her editorial. Dion said, "I read with interest and with some dismay the editorial in the Boston Globe by Courtney Black and Maxine Hanks on Mormon feminism. When one considers that the worldwide membership of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints exceeds 11 million, 50 signatures from around the world to their petition is an underwhelming show of support." Dion offered 3 points. 1, Hanks and Black do not speak for Mormon women. 2, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a feminist organization. 3, the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is to preach the gospel of Christ. Dion projected a number of false assumptions, and her language was condescending and condemnatory, even slanderous to both Courtney and I, engaging in personal attacks. She misconstrued and miscast our points and intent, creating a straw man argument and then attacking her own false assumption. Essentially, she missed the point of our editorial, not responding to our words, but to her own fears. Courtney and I both wrote responses to Elizabeth. Courtney mailed hers while I held mine for use on the website. In an eloquent letter, Courtney let Elizabeth know that she missed the point of our editorial. Quote, "You misunderstood our statement to mean that we were speaking for you. If you go back and read it carefully, you will see that we were speaking for the 50 women who signed. That said, I wish to reply to your letter, not in an effort to prove to you the correctness of my position, but rather to make my position clear. In my letter, I agreed with some of Elizabeth's points while taking issue with others. My main concern was that Elizabeth so quickly succumbed to the worst possible mistake which plagued Mormon feminists in the 70s. She sank into making our editorial a conflict between women, blaming feminists as the problem, rather than seeing the problem for what it is, a systemic dysfunction co-constructed by men who dominate and women who surrender their agency. Elizabeth showed strong apologetic views about Mormonism, which explained the energy of her attack on our editorial. When responding to others, it is easy to forget that we are talking to human beings with feelings. Elizabeth succumbed to this temptation by responding too harshly to us, which made her look bad. Conversely, our editorial had the basic premise of respecting the right of women to speak for themselves, which includes Elizabeth Dion. She abandoned our stronger position in favor of a weak one, engaging in scapegoating, blaming, personal attacks, and a basic women versus women, false dichotomy." More letters came in. Some were published on the in the Tribune and some circulate on the internet. Among them were strong responses from women to Elizabeth Dion. Meanwhile, letters were appearing in the Salt Lake Tribune Weekly. Here are a few excerpts. Jean in Salt Lake wrote, "I gotta admit there is a certain gravitas to seeing it in print in a real-life newspaper. Now GBH has to reword his answer to, I know there are a handful of women. You folks are a handful in more ways than one." Lynn Matthews Anderson of Massachusetts wrote, "I know dozens of women who fully agree with what was written, but who are too afraid of being punished to sign." Matthew Lassen of Salt Lake wrote, "I respect and admire the women willing to stand and be counted in the face of what I consider to be a rather chauvinistic social group, the LDS faith." Hildy Mitchell of Brighton, England wrote, "Elsewhere in the contemporary world, the right to voice is seen as a fundamental human right. We don't speak for all, but we surely do have a right to speak for ourselves." Dina Holmes of Salt Lake wrote, "We know that there is complaint and dissatisfaction among the women of the church. Our issues may be different from woman to woman, but the thread that runs through all of the issues is that our issues have been made light of by church leadership. We would like our church leadership simply to listen to us instead of saying, I haven't found a complaint." Joe Wilson of Salt Lake wrote regarding, the Dion rebuttal, "Your rebuttal explaining the feelings and positions of women who dare to question authority, that they are jeopardizing their very existence, family, friends, ethnic identity, and even inheritances, is the first time I've seen this explanation in print. I, for one, applaud the many women from around the country who have had the ovaries to sign their names." Okay. All right, let me just conclude. Okay, there's no conclusion. But our respondent maybe has a few words of conclusion.
Well, first of all, I'm not a woman. And secondly, when I first read the editorial, I felt quite sad because it all seemed so accurate to me, so true. Maxine asked me to offer some suggestions, which I did. It's a little too long, and I think at times it's a little too strong. Well, Maxine says the men tread on. That's a little too strong, I think. But overall, I really enjoyed it. And as I said, I was sad because I feel that this message is falling on ears that are quite deaf. However, the more I thought about it and Maxine talked to me about it, I realized that this is the only way that women can communicate with the top leadership, is through the secular voice. And even though the response, as Maxine says, has been pretty much silence, still, this is one more wedge, you know, working its way into the wall, one more chink out of the masonry to help with a long-term change. If you have any questions, I'm sure my wife would try to answer them for you.
Yeah, what is our website address? I've been to it once or twice. I think I don't know if it's down. I know that one of the sad things that's happened about the website, I'll talk to you privately afterwards and see if I can get that information to you, is that it's expensive to keep up, and Maxine has used her own funds to keep it up and has no other sources of income. So her vision of the website was that it would be a place, a repository, a library of feminist writing. That would not include just the kind of stuff that we produce at Sunstone, but would be inclusive of other forms of feminism, would be a place for all kinds of Mormon women with any kind of feminist interest or concern to network and be able to access whatever has been said by other Mormon feminists. But of course, to collect all those things, to catalog them and then put them on a website is time consuming, and Maxine is a single woman who has a limited income. She's a writer. She lives off of her writing, and she has to write in order to earn enough money, and then to have enough spare time and funds to do that has been just impossible. So at this time, I think the website, if not down, is dormant, and it's an as yet unfulfilled dream, but I think it's a wonderful notion. Because one of the problems Mormon feminists have had is that they've always had to reinvent the wheel, and they haven't been able they've lost each other and then reconnected and lost each other, et cetera, et cetera. And this would be the last time that happened. And also, there are some limitations to Mormon feminism that gets the most play, and that is that it reflects middle-class Mormon women from white America. And of course, the church is much larger than that, and it's of concern that women of other nationalities, backgrounds, economic and cultural situations be able to participate. Yes?
Would you
give me
your definition of a Mormon feminist?
Well, I like to call Mormon feminists feminist Mormons, because I think we are Mormons first, and as feminists, we are responding to the notion of female equality, and we have found enough evidence in Mormon theology to feel that there's no reason to leave Mormonism in order to create a satisfying feminism within our religion.
I'm not sure that's shared by all Mormon feminists, because there is no reason to leave.
Well, of course, there's various ways of leaving. I haven't been to church in 10 years. So I don't get anything out of going to church except grief, so I don't go. But I haven't lost my interest or my connection to other Mormons and to Mormon theology. But you might have had something more to say about that.
This is my personal opinion that I've come to a place where I doubt seriously that there will ever be significant changes unless enough women choose to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the numbers is what's important to them, and image is important. And the more public it becomes that women are so dissatisfied that they are leaving, and it isn't. Some women leave because they no longer believe the theology. Some women leave because it seems to be there, whatever the reason.
Some want to leave but can't and live in silent desperation.
Tons are there,
right?
Body only. But my sense is that until enough women leave, and that alters that base of, as they say from the pulpit, we couldn't survive without you women. Which, you know, basically
yes.
is true. You know, we can't survive without you, but we still want to accept Christ.
Yeah.
That's
what will make them like that. Well, I often fantasize about every Mormon woman saying to their husband, no sex until we have the priesthood. And I just imagined if we could all get together that suddenly we would have the priesthood. But, of course, how do you do that? You know, and so I see what you're saying. The reason that I say is because I can go away, but Mormonism is here to stay, I think, as a religion, at least for many, 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 many more decades, possibly centuries. Churches don't go away. I mean, Christianity wouldn't go away if suddenly they found Christ's body and we discovered he hadn't been resurrected. There'd just be like a two-century-long argument as to whether or not it was really Christ's body. And I love Mormon women. I want to offer them what I can so that whatever's left when I'm gone is better than what was there when I was part of it. So, and that's something that's okay for me to do because I'm interested in that sort of thing. I'm safe. My husband is a feminist. He's also left the church. He protects me from I mean, if I were excommunicated, there would be virtually no problem for me in my home. And so it's easy for me to give that. I don't think other women have that opportunity. So there are a variety of ways of expressing our feminism and Mormonism.
I consider myself a Mormon any longer, although I haven't actually officially had my name on this in the role. But I would say that as long as we give men the power to decide whether we have the priesthood or not, we're not truly feminist. Early in the church, in the history of the church, the women assumed that they had the priesthood, which indeed they had. The priesthood is the power and the authority to act in the name of God, and we all have that. It's part of being human.
It is, and I think it's a wonderful place to be. I feel in that place, and I think that it's, and I want it to be a place that other Mormon women can find for themselves, and I think my belief is they can find it within Mormon theology if they're stuck in it. If they aren't stuck in it, they can find it too. But wherever Mormon women are around, and they will always be, so I want to be with them, and others need to go where they need to go. I guess it's time for us to close. Right. Thank you so much for all your questions and interest.